Nilfgaard, Lord Pennycook, Mayor of Claremont, and this is Mr. Leo Bonnart, my relative and former comrade." Bonnart bowed stiffly.
"So, this is the little brigand who is to amuse us today," said the skinning marchioness,
staring intently at Ciri with her pale blue eyes. Years of drinking could be heard in her husky, seductive voice.
"Not too bad, I'd say, but nicely built. Quite a pleasant little bodykin."
Ciri jerked, pushing off an obtrusive hand, paled with fury and hissed like a serpent.
"Please don't touch," Bonnart said coldly. "Don't feed it. Don't tease it. I take no responsibility."
"A little bodykin."
The marchioness licked her lips, paying no attention to him.
"Can always be tied to a bed to make it more amenable. Perhaps you'd sell her to me, Mr. Bonnart, sir. My Marquesa and I like little bodykins like that. And Mr. Hovenagel is so reproachful when we seize local goose girls and peasant children. In any case, the Marquess can't hunt children any longer. He can't run because of those cankers and warts which have opened up in his crotch."
"Enough, enough, Matilda," Hovenagel said softly but quickly, seeing the expression of growing disgust on Bonnart's face. "We must leave for the theatre. Mr. Mayor has just been informed that Windsor Imbra has reached the town with a squad of the Baron of Cassaday's infantry, which means it's time."
Bonnart removed a flacon from his belt pouch, wiped the onyx tabletop with his sleeve, and tipped out a small mound of white powder. He pulled on the chain, drawing Ciri closer.
"Do you know how to use it?"
Ciri clenched her teeth.
"Sniff it up, or lick a finger and rub it into your gums."
"No." Bonnart didn't even turn his head.
"You'll do it yourself," he said softly. "Or I'll do it, only in a way that will supply everybody here with a bit of entertainment. You don't just have mucous membranes in your mouth and nose, little rat, but in a few other amusing places. I'll call for servants, have you stripped naked and restrained, and I'll take advantage of those amusing places."
The Marchioness de Nementh-Oivar laughed gutturally, watching Ciri reaching for the narcotic with a trembling hand.
"Amusing places," she repeated and licked her lips. "What a fascinating idea. Worth trying one day. Hey, girl, have a care. Don't waste good fish stick. Leave some for me."
The narcotic was much more powerful than the one she'd tried with the rats. A little while after taking it, Ciri was overcome by a dazzling euphoria. Contours were sharpened. Light and colours pricked her eyes. Smells irritated her nose. Sounds became unbearably loud, and everything around her became unreal, as ephemeral as a dream. There were the steps. There were the tapestries, stinking of thick dust. There was the husky laughter of the Marchioness de Nementh-Oivar. There was the courtyard, raindrops falling quickly on her face, and the jerking of the collar she still had around her neck. There was an immense building with a wooden tower and a large, repulsively tawdry painting on the frontage. The painting depicted dogs baiting a monster, neither a dragon, a griffin, nor a wyvern. There were people outside the entrance to the building. One was shouting and gesticulating.
"It's revolting, revolting and sinful, Mr. Hovenagel, to be utilizing a building which was once a place of worship for such an immoral, inhuman and disgusting practice. Animals also feel, Mr. Hovenagel. They also have their dignity. It's a crime to set animal against animal for the amusement of the common folk in the name of profit."
"Calm yourself, you pious fellow, and don't meddle in my private enterprise. In any case, no animal shall be baited today, not a single one. Exclusively people."
"Oh, then I do beg your pardon."
Inside, the building was full of people sitting on rows of benches, forming an amphitheatre. A pit had been dug in the centre, a circular depression measuring about 10 yards across, shored up by hefty posts and topped with a balustrade. The stench and uproar were overwhelming. Again, Ciri felt a tug on the collar, and somebody seized her under the arms, somebody shoved her. She suddenly found herself at the bottom of the pit, on firmly packed down sand, in the arena. The first rush had subsided, and now the narcotic was just stimulating her, sharpening her senses. Ciri pressed her hands over her ears. The crowd occupying the amphitheatre's benches roared, booed and whistled. The noise was unbearable. She noticed that her right wrist and forearm were tightly bound by a leather bracer. She couldn't recall it being fastened to her. She heard the familiar hoarse voice, saw the skinny, pistachio-coloured marchioness, the Nilfgaardian cavalry captain, the pastel-toned mare, Hoovenagel and Bonnard, occupying a box perched above the arena. Her hands went to her ears again as someone suddenly struck a copper gong.
"Look, good people! In the pit today there's no wolf, no goblin, no Endrega. In the arena today is the murderous Falka from the Rats Gang. The ticket desk by the entrance is taking bets. Don't stint a penny, good people. You can't eat this amusement, you can't drink it. But if you skimp on it, you'll not profit, you'll lose out."
The crowd roared and applauded. The narcotic was working. Ciri trembled with euphoria. Her vision and hearing were registering everything, every detail. She could hear Hoovenagel's cackle, the marchioness's husky laugh, the mayor's grave voice, Bonnard's cold bass, the yelling of the animal-loving priest, the squealing of women and the crying of a child. She could see dark patches of blood on the posts encircling the arena and a stinking grill-covered hole gaping in it. And brutishly contorted faces, glistening with sweat above the balustrade. A sudden commotion raised voices, curses. Armed men jostled the crowd, but ground to a halt, stopped by a wall of guards clutching partisans. She'd seen one of the men before. She remembered the swarthy face and the black moustache, like a line drawn in charcoal on his upper lip, which quivered in a tick.
"Mr. Windsor Imbra?"
It was Hoovenagel's voice.
"Of Giso, seneschal of his noble lordship, the Baron of Cassaday? Greetings, greetings to our foreign guests. Take your places, the spectacle is about to begin. But don't forget, please, to pay at the entrance."
"I'm not here for the sport, Mr. Hoovenagel. I'm here on matters of service. Bonnard knows of what I speak."
"Indeed, Leo? Do you know of what the seneschal speaks?"
"Do not jest. There are 15 of us here. We've come for Falka. Hand her over, or things will turn ill."
"I don't understand your excitation, Imbra," Hoovenagel frowned. "But I observe that this is not Giso, nor is it within the lands of that mandarin, your baron. Should you make a fuss and incommode us, I shall have you driven away with knouts."
"I wish to cause no offence, Mr. Hoovenagel," Windsor Imbra appealed. "But the law is on our side. Bonnard, here present, promised Falka to his grace, Baron of Cassaday. He gave his bond, and now he must keep it."
"Leo," Hoovenagel said, jowls shaking, "do you know what he's talking about?"
"I do, and I admit he's right."
Bonnard stood up, carelessly waving a hand.
"I shan't protest or cause any difficulties. The girl is here, as everybody sees. Whoever wishes to may take her."
Windsor Imbra was dumbfounded. His lip trembled intensely.
"How is that?"
"The girl," Bonnard repeated, winking at Hoovenagel, "belongs to the man who wishes to take her from the arena, alive or dead, as your taste dictates."
"How is that?"
"Damn it, I'm gradually losing my patience."
Bonnard skillfully feigned anger.
"Nothing but, how is that, bloody parrot?"
"How? However you wish. It's up to you. Poison some meat and throw it to her, as you would a she-wolf. But I can't guarantee she will devour it. She doesn't look stupid, does she?"
"No, Imbra. Whoever wants her must take the trouble of going down to her, down there into the pit. You want Falka? Then claim her."
"You wave Falka under my nose like a frog on a rod before a catfish," Windsor Imbra growled. I don't trust you, Bonnard. I can smell the iron hook hidden in that bait.
I congratulate you on your sensitive nose.
Bonnard stood up, took the sword acquired in Farno from under the bench, drew it from the scabbard, and threw it into the arena, so dexterously that the blade stuck vertically in the sand, 2 paces in front of Ciri.
There's your iron, out in the open, not concealed at all. I don't care for the wench, and whomsoever wants to may take her, if they're able.
The Marchioness de Nement Oiva laughed nervously. If they're able, she repeated in her husky contralto. For now the bodkin has a sword.
Bravo, Mr. Bonner. It seemed despicable to leave the bodkin defenseless and at the mercy of these good-for-nothings.
Mr. Hoovenagel, Windsor Imbra said with arms akimbo, not gracing the skinny aristocrat with even a glance. This spectacle is being held under your patronage, for it's your theatre, after all. Just tell me one thing. By whose rules and principles are we to play? Yours or Bonnard's?
By theatrical ones,
Hoovenagel cackled, shaking his belly and bulldog-like jowls.
For though it's true that it's my theatre, the customer is always right, as he who pays the piper calls the tune. The customer sets the rules, whilst we merchants must act according to those rules. Whatever the customer demands, we must give him.
Customer? You mean these folk?
Windsor Imbra gestured sweepingly across the packed auditorium.
All these folk who have paid to marvel at these marvels.
Business is business, Hoovenagel replied. If there is a demand for something, why not sell it? Do folk pay for a wolf fight? For Endrega and Aardvark fights? For baiting a badger and a barrel or a wyvern? Why are you so astonished, Imbra? Folk need circuses and spectacles as they do bread. Why, more than bread. Many of those here had it taken from their mouths. Now look at them, how their eyes shine. They can't wait for the games to begin.
But at games, Bonnard added, smiling spitefully, the appearances of sport must at least be observed. The brock, before the curs drag him from the barrel, may nip with its teeth. That's only sporting. And the girl has a blade. Let it also be sporting here. Well, good people, am I right?
The good people confirmed in an incoherent, though thunderous and joyful chorus, that Bonnard was absolutely right.
The Baron of Cathedae, Windsor Imbra said slowly, will not be pleased, Mr. Hoovenagel. I tell you, he'll not be pleased. I don't know if it's worth your while picking a fight with him.
Business is business,
Hoovenagel repeated, and jiggled his cheeks.
The Baron of Cassidy knows that very well. He has borrowed a deal of money from me at low interest, and when the time comes to borrow more, then we shall somehow smooth over our squabbles. But some foreign lord isn't going to interfere in my private enterprise. Wages have been laid, people have paid to enter. Blood must soak into that sand in that arena.
Must? Windsor Imbra yelled.
Bollocks! I'm itching to show you that it doesn't need to at all, for I shall leave here and ride away without looking back. Then you can spill your own blood. The very thought of supplying this rabble with amusement sickens me.
Let him go.
A character with a very low hairline in a horsehide jerkin emerged from the crowd.
If it sickens him, let him go. It doesn't sicken me. They said whoever does for the she-rat takes the reward. I volunteer to enter the arena.
Not lightly.
One of Imbra's soldiers, a short but wiry and well-built man, suddenly yelled. He had thick, unkempt and matted hair.
We was first, wasn't we, boys?
Yeah,
chimed in a second, a scrawny one with a pointed beard.
We had priority. And don't let your sense of honour get the better of you, Windsor. What of it, if the rebel is watching? Folkers in the pit suffice to hold that hand and take her, and let the peasantry goggle. We don't give a damn.
And we're ready to get something out of it, too,
snickered a third, dressed in a doublet of vivid amaranth,
Let's make sport of it. Am I right, Mr. Hoovenagel? Let's make a contest of it, as long as the reward's on offer.
Hoovenagel grinned and nodded, proudly and majestically jiggling his pendulous cheeks.
Well then,
asked the one with the goatee curiously,
are there any wages?
As of now, the merchant laughed, no one has wagered on the result. As of now, it's 3-1, since none of you dares enter the enclosure.
Huh? Horsard yelled. I dare, I'm minded. Out of way, I said,
Matted Hare roared back.
We was first, and we have first crack. Come on, what are we waiting for?
How many can go in at one time?
Amaranth tightened his belt.
Or is only one at a time allowed?
You horsens!
Quite unexpectedly, the pastel mare suddenly roared in a powerful voice, utterly incongruent with his build.
Perhaps 10 of you want to take on the one of her, on horseback, perhaps, riding chariots, perhaps. Perhaps you want to borrow a catapult from the armory in order to hurl boulders at the wench from afar, eh?
Very well, very well,
Bonnart interrupted, after swiftly consulting with Hoovenagel.
Let it be sport, but let there be entertainment, too. We'll say 2 at a time. You may enter in pairs.
But the reward, Hoovenagel warned, will not be doubled. If it's 2, you'll have to share.
In pairs? 2 at a time?
Matted Hare, flung his cape from his shoulders.
Are you ashamed, boys? She's just a wench.
He spat on the ground.
Stand back. I'll go myself and take her down. Big deal.
I want Volker alive,
protested Windsor Imbra.
A pox on your fights and duels. I won't go along with Bonnart's circus. I want the wench alive. You two go in, you and Stavro, and haul her out of there.
As for me,
Stavro, the one with the goatee, said, it's an insult for 2 of us to take on that scrawny thing.
The Baron's florins will make that insult more palatable, but only if she's alive.
The Baron's a miser,
Hoovenagel cackled, wobbling his belly and bulldog's jowls.
He doesn't have an ounce of sporting spirit in him, nor the desire to reward that spirit in others. I, though, champion sport, and hereby increase the reward. Whomsoever enters the arena alone and leaves it on his own 2 feet will be paid by this very hand from this very coffer, not 20, but 30 florins.
So, what are we waiting for? Yelled Stavro. I'm going first.
Not so fast,
the short mare roared once again.
The wench has but thin linen on her back, so cast off that brigandine, soldier. This is sport.
Ah, pox on ye.
Stavro stripped off the studded caftan, then pulled his shirt off over his head, revealing a scrawny chest and arms as hairy as a baboon.
A pox on ye, my lords, and ye sodding sport. I'll go in a buff. Shall I take off my breeches, too?
And your braes, the Marchioness de Nemeth Oiva croaked seductively. Then we'll see if you're only manly and worth.
Rewarded by thunderous applause and naked to the waist, Stavro drew his weapon and threw one leg over the barrier, watching Ciri intently. Ciri folded her arms over her chest. She didn't even take a step towards the sword plunged into the sand. Stavro hesitated.
Don't do it, said Ciri very softly. Don't make me. I won't let you touch me.
Don't begrudge me, wench.
Stavro clambered over the barrier.
I've nothing against you, but business is...
He didn't complete the sentence, for Ciri was already on him, was already holding Swallow, as she had named the gnomish Gwaiir. She used a very simple, downright childish attack and feint called 3 little steps. But Stavro was taken in by it. He took a step backwards and raised his sword involuntarily, and was then at her mercy. After stepping back, he was leaning against a post, and Swallow's blade was 1 inch from the tip of his nose.
That move,
Bonnart explained to the Marchioness, shouting over the roaring and applause,
is called 3 little steps, a feint and a lunge in tierce. A cheap trick. I'd expected something more refined from the wench, though one must admit, if she'd wanted it, the fellow would already be dead.
Kill him! Kill him!
The spectators bellowed, and Hoovenagel and Mayor Pennycook pointed their thumbs downwards. The blood had drained from Stavro's face, and the pimples and pockmarks on his cheeks were repugnantly visible.
I told you not to make me, Ciri hissed. I don't want to kill you, but I won't let anyone touch me. Go back where you came from.
She moved back, turned around, put down her sword, and looked up towards the box.
Are you toying with me?
She cried, voice breaking.
Do you mean to force me to fight? To kill? You can't do it. I won't fight.
Hear that, Imbra?
Bonnart's sneering voice resounded in the silence.
Clear profit and no risk. She won't fight. Thus, you can take her from the arena and deliver her alive to the Baron of Cassaday, so he can freely amuse himself with her. You can take her without any danger, with your bare hands.
Windsor, Imbra, spat. Stavro, still standing with his back pressed against the post, panted, gripping his sword. Bonnard laughed.
But I, Imbra, bet a diamond to a walnut that you can't.
Stavro took a deep breath. The girl, standing with her back to him, appeared distracted, preoccupied. He was seething with rage, shame, and hatred. He couldn't control himself. He attacked swiftly and treacherously. The audience didn't notice the swerve or reverse thrust. All they saw was the rushing Stavro making a truly balletic leap, after which, less balletically, he fell belly and face down in the sand. Sand which was immediately stained red with blood.
Instinct takes the upper hand, Bonnart shouted over the crowd. Reflexes come into play. Hey, Hufvenagel? What did I say? You'll see. The mastiffs won't be needed.
What a splendid and profitable spectacle, Hufvenagel said, closing his eyes in bliss.
Stavro raised himself on trembling arms, jerked his head, cried out, croaked, puked blood, and slumped down on the sand.
"What's that blue gold, Mr. Bonnart, sir?" the Marchioness de Nemeth Oivar asked huskily and sensuously, rubbing her knees together.
"That was improvised."
The teeth of the bounty hunter, who didn't even look at the Marchioness, flashed from beneath his lips.
"An exquisite, inspired, and I'd say visceral improvisation. I've heard of a place where they teach that kind of improvised butchery. I'll wager our maiden knows it well. Now I know who she is."
"Don't make me!"
Ciri screamed, a truly ghastly note trembling in her voice.
"I don't want to. Understand? I don't want to."
"You hellish slut."
Amaranth nimbly vaulted the barrier, circling the arena to distract Ciri from Matted Hair, who was entering from the opposite side. Horsehide cleared the barrier behind Matted Hair.
"That's fighting dirty,"
roared the halfling-sized mare, Pennycook, who was sensitive to fair play, and the crowd yelled with him.
"Three against one, that's unfair."
Bonnart laughed. The Marchioness licked her lips and began to wriggle her legs more urgently. The threesome's plan was simple. Pin the retreating girl against the posts. Then two would block and the third one kill. Nothing came of it for a simple reason. The girl didn't retreat, but attacked. She slipped between them with a balletic pirouette, so lightly she almost didn't touch the sand. She struck Matted Hair in passing, precisely where he ought to be struck, in the carotid artery. The blow was so subtle, it didn't jar her rhythm. She ducked away in a reverse feint, so swiftly that not a single drop of the blood gushing from Matted Hair's neck in a 2-yard stream fell on her. Amaranth, behind her, aimed to slash across the back of her neck, but his treacherous blow clanged against the lightning-fast parry of her blade, held up behind her. Ciri unwound like a spring, slashing with both hands, amplifying the blow's power with a jerk of her hips. The dark, gnomish blade was like a razor, and cut his abdomen open with a hiss and a squelch. Amaranth howled and flopped forward onto the sand, curling up into a ball. Horsehide leapt at Ciri and thrust towards her throat, but she dodged, spun fluidly, and struck from close quarters with the middle of the blade, mutilating his eye, nose, mouth, and chin. The spectators yelled, whistled, stamped their feet, and bayed for more. The Marchioness de Nemeth Oivar thrust both hands between her clenched thighs, licked her shining lips, and laughed in her nervous drinker's contralto. The captain of the Nilfgaardian Reserve horse was as wan as vellum. A woman tried to cover the eyes of her child as he wriggled free. A grizzled old man in the front row vomited loudly and spasmodically and hung his head between his knees. Horsehide sobbed, holding his face, as blood mixed with snot and spit poured through his fingers. Amaranth rolled around, squealing like a stuck hog. Matted Hare stopped scrabbling against a post, slippery with blood, spurting from him in the rhythm of his heartbeat.
"Help me!"
Amaranth howled, tightly clutching his innards, spilling out of his belly.
"Comrades, help me!
Horsehide spat and snorted blood.
"Finish him off! Finish him off!"
chanted the audience, stamping their feet to the rhythm. The puking old man was shoved from the bench and kicked towards the gallery.
"A diamond to a walnut," Bonnot's sneering bass resounded amongst the racket, "that none will now dare enter the arena." "A diamond to a walnut, Imbra. What am I saying? Even to an empty walnut shell."
"Kill 'em!"
A roaring thumping of feet and clapping.
"Kill 'em!"
"Noble maiden,"
Windsor Imbra shouted, gesturing his subordinates to go forward. "Let them remove the wounded. Let them enter the arena and take them before they bleed to death. Have a heart, noble maiden."
"A heart?"
Ciri repeated with effort, only then feeling the adrenaline strike her. She got herself quickly under control with a series of well-drilled breaths.
"Come in and take them," she said. "But come in unarmed. Have a heart as well. Just this once."
"No!"
the crowd roared and chanted.
"We want blood! We want blood!"
"You rotten bastards!"
Ciri turned around gracefully, sweeping her gaze over the stands and benches.
"You despicable swine! You scoundrels! You lousy horsons! You want blood? Come here. Come down, taste it and smell it. Lick it up before it clots. Bastards! Vampires!"
The Marchioness groaned, trembled, fluttered her eyelashes and softly nestled up to Bonhart without taking her hands from between her thighs. Bonhart grimaced and shoved her away from him, not bothering to be gentle. The crowd howled. Someone threw a half-chewed sausage into the arena, someone else a boot, and yet another chucked a gherkin aimed at Ciri. She sliced the gherkin in two with a flourish of her sword, provoking an even louder roar. Windsor Imbra and his men picked up Amaranth and Horsehide. When Amaranth was touched, he howled, while Horsehide fainted. Matted Hare and Stavro no longer showed any signs of life. Ciri moved back to stand as far away as the arena permitted. Imbra's men also did their best to stay away from her. Windsor Imbra stood motionless. He waited until they had heaved out the dead and wounded. He looked at Ciri through narrowed eyes, his hand on the hilt of his sword, which, despite his promise, he had not removed on entering the arena.
"No,"
she warned, barely moving her lips.
"Don't make me, please."
Imbra was pale. The crowd stamped their feet, roared and howled.
"Don't listen to her," Bonhart shouted over the racket again. "Draw your sword. Otherwise, it'll get out that you're a coward and a turd. From the Alba to the Yaruga, everyone will be talking about how Windsor Imbra ran from a slip of a girl with his tail between his legs."
Imbra's blade slid an inch from the scabbard.
"Don't,"
said Ciri. The blade went back in.
"Coward!"
roared someone from the crowd.
"Shithead! Chicken heart!"
His face impassive, Imbra walked to the edge of the arena. Before seizing the hands of his comrades reaching down from above, he turned back one last time. "You probably know what you're in for, wench," he said softly. You probably already know what Leo Bonhard is. You probably already know what Leo Bonhard's capable of, what excites him. You'll be shoved out into the arena to kill for the amusement of the swine and scum in here, and even worse than them. And when the fact that you can kill stops amusing them, when Bonhard tires of doing violence to you, then they'll kill you too. They'll send so many to face you, you won't be able to watch your back, or they'll set dogs on you. And the dogs will tear you apart, and the rabble in the stands will sniff blood and applaud. You'll expire on this blood-stained sand, like the men you slaughtered today. You'll remember my words. Oddly, it was only then that she noticed the small escutcheon on his enamel gorget, a silver unicorn rampant on a black field. A unicorn. Ciri lowered her head. She looked at her sword's openwork ricasso. Everything suddenly went quiet.
By the great sun, Declan Ross Eb Mechlad, the captain of the Nilfgaardian reserve horse, abruptly began.
No. Don't do that, girl. Natuven kes luneth.
Ciri slowly turned Swallow around in her hand and rested the pommel on the sand. She went down on one knee, holding the blade with her right hand. She aimed the point with her left towards her breastbone. The blade cut through her clothing and pricked her at once.
Just don't cry, thought Ciri,
pushing harder and harder down on the sword.
Just don't cry, there's nothing to cry over. One quick thrust and it will all be over. It will all be over.
You won't do it.
Bonhart's voice resounded in the complete silence.
You won't do it, Witcher girl. In Caer Morhen, you were taught how to kill, so you kill like a machine, instinctively. To kill yourself, you need character, strength, determination, and courage. And they couldn't teach you that.
He was right, Ciri said with effort. I couldn't.
Visogotta remained silent. He was holding a koipu pelt, motionless. Had been for a long time. He had almost forgotten about the pelt as he listened.
I chickened out. I was a coward. And I paid for it. As every coward pays for it. In pain, dishonor, and hideous humiliation. And an absolute revulsion towards myself.
Visogotta said nothing. Had someone crept up to the cottage with the sunken thatched roof that night? Had they peered through the slits in the shutters? They would have seen in the dimly lit interior a grey-bearded old man and an ashen-haired girl sitting by the fireplace. They would have noticed that the two of them were staring silently into the glowing ruby coals. But no one could have seen it, for the cottage with the sunken moss-grown thatched roof was well hidden among the fog and the mist, in a boundless swamp in the Periplut marshes, where no one dared to venture. Whosoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Genesis chapter 9, verse 6. Verily, great self-righteousness and great blindness are needed to call the gore pouring from the scaffold justice. Visogotta of Corvo. Chapter 5.
What seeks the Witcher on my territory?
Fulca Alteverde, the prefect of Riedbrunner, repeated the question, now clearly impatient with the lengthening silence.
Whence is the Witcher coming? And whither is he headed? With what purpose?
That's what comes of playing at good deeds, thought Geralt, looking at the prefect's face, which was marked with thickened scars. That's what comes of playing the noble witcher out of compassion for a bunch of shabby forest folk. That's what comes of the desire for luxury and sleeping in taverns where there's always a narc. That's what comes of travelling with a loud-mouthed poetaster. Here I sit, in a room like a windowless cell, and a hard interrogation chair bolted to the floor, and on the chair's back, it's impossible not to notice, are cuffs and leather straps for binding the arms and restraining the neck. They haven't been used yet, but they're there. How the bloody hell do I get myself out of this pickle now? After 5 days of trekking with the Rivadellian forest beekeepers, they finally emerged from the wilderness onto a boggy reed bed. It stopped raining. The wind dispersed the mists and clammy fog. The sun broke through the clouds, and mountain peaks sparkled snow-white in the glare. If a short while ago the river Yaruga had signified to them a clear dividing line, a border, the crossing of which represented an evident passage to the next more serious stage of the expedition, it was even more so now. The sense that they were approaching a limit, a barrier, a place which could only be turned back from. They all felt it, Geralt above all. It could only be thus, since from dawn to dusk they had been faced with a mighty, jagged range of mountains barring their way, rising up in front of them to the south, and gleaming with snow and glaciers. The Amel Mountains. And rising even above the saw-toothed Amel was the forbiddingly majestic obelisk of Mount Gorgon, Devil Mountain, as angular as the blade of a misericord. They did not talk about it, didn't discuss it, but Geralt felt what everybody was thinking. For when he looked at the Amel Range and Gorgon, the thought of continuing the journey southwards seemed sheer insanity. Fortunately, it suddenly turned out there would be no need to head south. This news was brought to them by the shaggy forest beekeeper, owing to whom they had acted as the train's armed escort for the previous 5 days. The husband and father of the comely Hamadryads, next to whom he looked like a wild boar beside two mares. He, who had tried to deceive them by saying the druids of Caerdhu had gone to the slopes. It was the day after their arrival in Uridbruna, a town teeming like an anthill, and the destination of the forest beekeepers and trappers from Rivadel. It was the day after parting with the forest beekeepers, for whom the Witcher was no longer needed. He hadn't expected to see any of them again. His astonishment was thus all the greater. For the forest beekeeper began with effusive expressions of gratitude and the handing to Geralt of a full pouch of mainly small change, his witcher's fee. He accepted it, feeling on him the somewhat mocking gaze of Regis and Caer, to whom he had occasionally moaned during the trek about human ingratitude and stressed the pointlessness and stupidity of selfless altruism. And then the excited beekeeper literally shouted out the news. "The, you know, mistletoes? I mean the druids. Are camped, dear Master Witcher, in the oak groves by Loch Monduin. A lake, get my drift, 35 miles from here in a westerly direction." The beekeeper had heard these tidings at a honey and beeswax trade market from a relative living in Uridbruna, while the relative had been given the information from a diamond prospector, acquaintance of his. When the beekeeper learned about the druids, he ran as quickly as he could to tell the Witcher, and now he was glowing with happiness, pride, and a sense of importance, like every liar when his lies accidentally turn out to be true. At first, Geralt had intended to make for Loch Monduin without a moment's delay, but the company protested vehemently. Being in possession of the money from the beekeepers, declared Regis and Caer, and being in a town where anything could be bought, they ought to stock up on victuals and supplies. "And buy extra arrows," added Milva, because they were always demanding game from her, and she weren't going to shoot whittle sticks. "And spend at least one night in a bed in an inn," added Dandelion, and retired to that bed, bathed and pleasantly tipsy on ale. "The druids," they chorused, "won't run away." "Utter coincidence though it may be," added the vampire Regis with a curious smile, "our company is on exactly the right road and heading in exactly the right direction. For since we are clearly and absolutely destined to encounter the druids, a day or two's delay makes no difference. And as regards haste," he added philosophically, "the impression that time is quickly running out is customarily a warning signal enjoining one to reduce the pace and proceed slowly and with due prudence." Geralt didn't protest or argue with the vampire's philosophy, although the weird nightmares he was being haunted by still inclined him towards haste, despite his being unable to recollect them after waking. It was the 17th of September, and a full moon. 6 days remained until the autumn equinox. Milva, Regis, and Caer took upon themselves the task of making purchases and acquiring the necessary equipment. Geralt and Dandelion, however, were to reconnoitre and gather information in the town of Riedebrunne. Situated in a bend in the River Nevi, Riedebrunne was a small town, if one only took into consideration the densely grouped brick and wooden buildings inside the ring of earthen embankments bristling with a palisade. But the serried buildings inside the embankments were currently merely the centre of the town, and no more than a tenth of the population could live there. Nine-tenths resided in the noisy ocean of ramshackle huts, shacks, cabins, sheds, tents and wagons, serving as dwellings which surrounded the embankments. The witcher and the poet were served by Cicerone in the form of the beekeeper's relative. Young, artful and arrogant, a typical specimen of an urban layabout, who'd been born in the gutter and was no stranger to bathing nor slaking his thirst there. This stripling was like a trout in a crystal-clear mountain stream in the urban hubbub, throng, grime and stench, and the chance to show someone around his repugnant town clearly delighted him. Unconcerned that nobody was asking him any questions, the gutter snipe gave enthusiastic explanations. He explained that Riedebrunne was an important stage for Nilfgaardian settlers, travelling northwards after the endowment pledged by the Emperor. 6 ox gangs, or roughly 120 acres, and on top of that, a 10-year tax moratorium. For Riedebrunne lay at the mouth of the Dol Nevi Valley, which cuts through the Amel Mountains via the Theodula Pass, linking the slopes and Riverdale with Magturga, Giso, Metina and Mecht, all countries for many years subordinate to the Nilfgaardian Empire. The town of Riedebrunne, explained the guttersnipe, was the last place where the settlers could depend on something else and not just themselves, their womenfolk and what they had in their wagons, which is why most of the settlers remained camped outside the town for quite some time, gathering their strength before the last push to the banks of the Yeruga and beyond. And many of them, he added, with the pride of a slum patriot, settled in the town permanently, because the town was, why, culture, not some yokelish dump stinking of dung. In truth, the town of Riedebrunne's stench drew on many smells, dung included. Geralt had been there years before, but couldn't recognise it. Too much had changed. Previously, there hadn't been so many cavalrymen in black armour and cloaks with silver emblems on their spaulders. Previously, the Nilfgaardian tongue had not been heard on all sides. Previously, there hadn't been a quarry outside the town, where now, ragged, dirty, haggard and bloodied people split boulders into ashlars and rubble, whipped by black-uniformed overseers. A large force of Nilfgaardian soldiers are stationed here, explained the guttersnipe, but not permanently, only during breaks in marches and searches for the partisans of the Free Slopes organisation. They'll be setting up a powerful Nilfgaardian garrison here when a great stone stronghold is constructed on the site of the old castle. A stronghold built of stone hard won from the quarry. The people splitting the stone are prisoners of war, from Lyria, from Adian, and lately from Sodden, Brugge and Angren, and Temeria. 400 prisoners are employed here in Riedebrunne. A good 500 work in the ore quarries, underground and open-cast mines, in the vicinity of Belhaven, and over 1,000 are building bridges and levelling roads in the Theodula Pass. There had also been a scaffold in the town square when Geralt had visited, but a much more modest one. There hadn't been so many devices arousing hideous associations on it, and there hadn't been so many revolting and putrid decorations hanging from the gallows, stakes, forks and poles. That's thanks to Mr. Fulco Artivelde, the prefect recently installed by the military authorities, explained the guttersnipe, looking at the scaffold and the fragments of human anatomy gracing it. Mr. Fulco had given the hangman business again. There's no fooling around with Mr. Fulco, he added. He's a stern master. The diamond prospector, the guttersnipe's mate, who they found in the tavern, didn't make a good impression on Geralt, for he happened to be in that tremblingly pale, half-sober, half-drunk, half-real, almost nightmarish state which drinking for several nights and days without stopping puts a fellow into. The witch's heart sank. It looked as though the sensational news about the druids might have originated in simple delirium tremens. The drink-sodden prospector answered their questions astutely, however, and with good sense. He wittily retorted to Dandelion's accusation that he didn't look like a diamond prospector by saying that he would if he ever found a diamond. He described the dwelling place of the druids by Loch Mondwyn explicitly and precisely, without exaggerated embellishment or an overinflated fantasizing manner. He took the liberty of asking what his interlocutors wanted from the druids and, when treated to a contemptuous silence, warned them that entering the druidic oak groves meant certain death, since the druids were wont to grab intruders, shove them into a basket called the Wicker Woman, and burn them alive, to the accompaniment of prayers, chants, and incantations. The groundless rumour and foolish superstition, it turned out, had dogged the druids, resolutely keeping up, never lagging more than 2 furlongs behind. Further conversation was interrupted by 9 soldiers in black uniforms with the sign of the sun on their spaulders, armed with guisarme.
"Would you be?" asked the sergeant, commanding the soldiers, tapping his calf with an oaken truncheon. "The witcher Geralt?"
"Yes," Geralt answered after a moment's reflection.
"I would." "You'll be coming along with me, then?" "How can you be sure I will? Am I under arrest?"
The soldier looked at him in a seemingly endless silence, but somehow strangely without respect. No doubt his 8-man escort gave him the nerve to look in that manner.
"No," he said at last, "you aren't under arrest. I received no order to arrest you. If I'd received an order, my question would have been different, sir. Very different."
Geralt adjusted his sword belt rather ostentatiously.
"And my answer," he said icily, "would have been different too."
"Now, now, gentlemen,"
Dandelion decided to step in, putting on an expression which, in his opinion, was the smile of a seasoned diplomat.
"Why that tone? We are honest men. We needn't fear the powers that be. Why, we're willing to help them, whenever the opportunity arises. But by virtue of that, we deserve something from authority, don't we, officer? If only something as tiny as an explanation of why our civic freedoms are being curtailed."
"There's a war on, sir,"
the soldier replied, not in the least bit disconcerted by the torrent of words.
"Freedom, as the name suggests, is a matter for peacetime. Any reasons will be elucidated by his lordship the prefect. I carry out orders, so don't get into discussions with me."
"Fair enough," the witcher conceded, and gave the troubadour a slight wink. "Then lead us to the prefecture, good soldier."
"Dandelion, go back to the others and tell them what's happened. Do the necessary. Regis will know what to do."
"What's a witcher doing in the slops? What do you seek?"
The person asking the questions was a broad-shouldered, dark-haired man, with a face rutted with scars and a leather patch over his left eye. In a dark alleyway, the sight of that cyclopean face was capable of wresting a moan of terror from many a breast. But how unjust when it was the face of Mr. Fulco Artevelde, prefect of Riedbrunner, the highest-ranking custodian of law and order in the entire region.
"What does a witcher seek in the slops?" repeated the highest-ranking custodian of law and order in the entire region.
Geralt sighed and shrugged, feigning indifference.
"You'll know, of course, the answer to your question, Prefect. You could only have gleaned the fact that I'm a witcher from the Riverdale Forest beekeepers, who hired me to protect them on their march. And, being a witcher in the slops or anywhere else, I'm generally in search of the chance to work. So I'm journeying in the direction suggested by the patrons who hired me."
"Logical," Fulco Artevelde nodded. "On the face of it, at least. You parted company with the beekeepers 2 days ago, but you intend to continue your travels southwards in somewhat peculiar company. With what aim?"
Geralt didn't lower his eyes, but steadily returned the burning gaze of the prefect's only eye.
"Am I under arrest?"
"No, not for the time being."
"Then the purpose and direction of my travel is my private business."
"I suggest frankness and openness, nonetheless, if only in order to prove you don't feel in any way guilty, and don't fear either the law or any authority guarding it. I'll repeat the question. What is behind your expedition, Witcher?"
Geralt pondered this briefly.
"I'm trying to reach the druids, who were abiding in Angren, but have probably moved into these parts. It would have been easy to learn that from the beekeepers I was escorting."
"Who hired you to deal with the druids?
The guardians of nature haven't burned 1 too many people in the Wicker Woman, have they?"
"Fairy tales, rumours, superstitions. Strange for an enlightened person like yourself. I want information from the druids, not their blood. But really, Prefect, it seems to me I've been too frank in order to prove I don't feel guilty."
"It's not about your guilt. At least, not just about it. I'd like, nevertheless, a tone of mutual congeniality to prevail in our talk, for in spite of appearances, the aim of this talk is, among others, to save you and your companions' lives.
You have provoked my sincere curiosity, my lord prefect, answered Geralt after some time. Among other things, I shall hear out your explanations with truly rapt attention.
I don't doubt it. We'll get to those explanations, but gradually, in stages. Have you ever heard, Master Vitra, of the tradition of turning imperial evidence?
Do you know what that is?
I do. Weaseling out of one's responsibilities by fingering one's comrades. A gross simplification, Fulco Artevelde said without smiling. Typical, actually, for a Nordling. You often disguise gaps in your education with sarcastic or exaggerated simplifications which you consider witty. Imperial lore operates here in the slopes, Master Vitra. More precisely, imperial lore is going to operate here when rank lawlessness has been utterly extirpated. The best way to fight lawlessness and criminality is the scaffold, which you surely saw in the town square. But occasionally, the offer to turn imperial evidence also works. He made a dramatic pause. Geralt didn't interrupt.
Quite recently, the prefect continued, we managed to lure a gang of juvenile criminals into an ambush. The brigands offered resistance and were killed.
But not all of them, right? Geralt conjectured bluntly, becoming a little bored by all this oratory. One was taken alive. They were promised a reprieve if they turned imperial evidence. I mean, if they started grassing. And they grassed me up.
Why such a deduction? Have you had any contact with the local criminal underworld? Now, or in the past?
No, I haven't. Not now, or in the past. So, forgive me, Lord Prefect, but the whole matter is either a complete misunderstanding, or humbug, or a trap directed against me. In the latter case, I would suggest we don't waste any more time and proceed to the nub of the matter.
It appears that the thought of a trap troubles you, the prefect observed, furrowing his scarred brow.
Could you, perhaps, in spite of your assurances, have some reason to fear the law?
No. I'm beginning, though, to fear that the fight against crime is being conducted hurriedly, wholesale, and not meticulously enough, without painstaking inquiries to determine guilt or innocence. But, well, perhaps that's just an exaggerated simplification, typical of a dull Nordling. And this Nordling continues not to understand in what way the prefect of Rydbruna is saving his life.
Fulco Artevelde observed him in silence for a moment, then clapped his hands.
Bring her in,
he ordered the soldiers, who'd appeared at his signal. Geralt calmed himself with several breaths, for suddenly a certain thought made his heart race and his adrenaline flow. A moment later, he had to take several more breaths, and even, astonishingly, had to make a sign with his hand out of sight beneath the table. And the effect, astonishingly, was none. He felt hot and cold. For the guards had shoved Ciri into the room.
Well, I never, said Ciri,
right after she'd been sat down in a chair and had her hands handcuffed behind the backrest.
Look what the cat's dragged in.
Artevelde made a brief gesture. One of the guards, a huge fellow with the face of a slow-witted child, drew his arm back in an unhurried swing and struck Ciri in the face so hard it made the chair rock.
Forgive her, your lordship, said the guard apologetically and astonishingly mildly. She is young and foolish, skittish.
Angoulême, Artevelde said slowly and emphatically. I promised you I'd hear you out. But I meant I'd listen to your answers to my questions, not to your badinage. You will be rebuked for your lack of respect. Understand?
Sure, nuncle.
The gesture. The slap. The chair rocked.
Young, mumbled the guard, rubbing his hand on his hip. Skittish.
From the young woman's snub nose, Geralt could see now that it wasn't Ciri, and was astonished at his mistake. Trickled a thin stream of blood. The young woman sniffed hard and smiled predatorily.
Angoulême, the prefect repeated. Do you understand me?
Yes, sir, Mr. Fulco.
Who's this, Angoulême? The girl sniffed again, inclined her head and fixed Geralt with her huge eyes. Hazel, not green. Then she shook her untidy mane of flaxen hair, causing it to fall onto her forehead in unruly locks.
Never seen him before.
She licked the blood which dripped onto her lip. But I know who he is.
Anyway, I already told you that, Mr. Fulco. Now you know I wasn't lying. His name's Geralt. He's a witcher. He crossed the Yaruga about 10 days ago, and he's heading for Toussaint. Right, my white-haired nuncle?
She's young, skittish, said the guard quickly, looking somewhat anxiously at the prefect. But Fulco Artevelde just grimaced and shook his head. You'll still be fooling about on the scaffold, Angoulême. Very well, let's go on. With whom, according to you, was Geralt the Witcher travelling?
I've already told you that, too. With a comely fellow called Dandelion, who's a troubadour and carries a lute, and a young woman who has dark, blonde, chin-length hair. I don't know her name. And another man without a description. His name wasn't mentioned either. 4 of them in all.
Geralt rested his chin on his knuckles, observing the girl with interest. Angoulême didn't lower her gaze.
What eyes you have, she said. Creepy peepers.
Continue, Angoulême, continue, Mr. Fulco urged, scowling. Who else belonged to this witcher's cohort?
No one. I said there were 4 of them. Not been listening, Nuncle.
The gesture, the slap, the trickle. The guard kneaded his hip, but refrained from any more comments about the skittishness of youth.
You lie, Angoulême, said the prefect. How many of them are there? I ask for the second time.
Whatever you say, Mr. Fulco, whatever you say, as you wish. There's 200 of them, 300, 600.
Lord Prefect.
Geralt forestalled the order to strike.
Let's leave it, if we may. What she said is precise enough to show she's not lying, at most lacking in information.
But where did she get her facts?
She declared she's never seen me before. It's the first time I've seen her too, I gave my word.
Thank you.
Artevelde frowned at him.
For your help with the investigation, how valuable. Then I started interrogating you. I count on your being equally eloquent. Angoulême, did you hear what the gentleman said? Speak, and don't make me encourage you.
It was said, replied the girl, as she licked the blood dripping from her nose, that if the authorities were informed about a planned crime, if it was revealed who was planning villainy, there'd be clemency. So I'm telling you, ain't I? I know about a crime being prepared, and I want to forestall the evil deed. Listen to what I say. Nightingale and his Hanser are waiting in Belhaven for this here witcher, and I plan to club him to death there. A half-elf gave them the contract. A stranger. No one knows where the hell he's from. No one knows him. The half-elf said it all. Who he is, what he looks like, where he's from, when he'll arrive, in what company. He warned that the witch is no mug, but an old hand. So not to play the hero, but stab him in the back, down him with a crossbow, or better yet, poison him, if he eats or drinks somewhere in Belhaven. The half-elf gave Nightingale some money, a lot of money, and promised there'd be more after the job's done.
After it's done, Fulco Artevelde remarked. So, the half-elf is still in Belhaven, with Nightingale's gang?
Perhaps, I don't know. It's over a fortnight since I escaped from Nightingale's hands.
So would that be the reason you're grassing them up? The witcher smiled. Settle in scores.
The young woman's eyes narrowed and her swollen mouth twisted.
Leave my sodding scores out of this, Nuncle. And me grassing is saving your life, right? Some thanks would be in order.
Thank you.
Geralt again prevented the beating. I only meant to remark that of your settling scores, it diminishes your credibility to turn imperial evidence. People grass to save their skin and their life. But they lie when they want revenge.
Our Angoulême has no chance of saving her life, Fulco Artevelde interjected. But she wants, naturally, to save her skin. To me, that's an absolutely credible motive. Well, Angoulême, you do want to save your skin, don't you?
The girl pursed her lips and visibly blanched.
The boldness of a criminal, said the prefect contemptuously. And of a snot-nosed kid at the same time. Swoop down in numbers, rob the weak, kill kill the defenseless, oh yes. Look death in the eye? Not so easy. That's beyond you.
We shall see,
she snarled. We shall, nodded Fulco gravely. And we shall hear. You'll bellow your lungs out on the scaffold, Angoulême.
You promised me clemency.
And I shall keep my promise, if what you have testified proves to be the truth.
Angoulême jerked on the chair, pointing at Geralt with a movement seemingly of her whole slim body.
And that? She yelled. What's that? Isn't that the truth? Let him deny he's a witcher, and he's Geralt. Let him say I'm not credible. Let him ride to Belhaven, and you'll have better proof that I'm not lying. You'll find his corpse in some gutter in the morning. But then you'll say I didn't prevent a crime, so the clemency will still come to nothing. That right? You're fucking swindlers. Nothing but swindlers.
Don't hit her, said Geralt. Please?
There was something in his voice that checked the raised hands of the prefect and the guard. Angoulême sniffed, looking at him piercingly.
Thanks, Nuncle, she said, but beating's nothing much. If they won't, let him carry on. I've been beaten since a child. I'm used to it. If you want to be kind, confirm I'm telling the truth. Let them keep their word. Let them sodding hang me.
Take her away, Fulco ordered, quietening Geralt, who was about to protest with a gesture. She is of no use to us, he explained once they were alone. I know everything, and you shall have your explanations, and then I shall ask for reciprocity. First of all, the witch's voice was cold. Explain what that noisy exit was all about, ending with that curious request to be hanged. If she's turned imperial evidence, the girl's done her work, hasn't she?
Not yet.
How is that?
Homer Stragan, nicknamed Nightingale, is an exceptionally dangerous scoundrel. Cruel and brazen, cunning and clever, and a lucky rogue. His impunity emboldens others. I must put an end to it, which is why I made a deal with Angoulême. I promised her that if, as a result of her testimony, Nightingale is captured and his gang broken up, she will hang.
I beg your pardon.
The witch's astonishment was genuine.
Is that what you call turning imperial evidence here? The noose in exchange for collaboration with the authorities? And what for refusing to collaborate?
Impalement, preceded by gouging out the eyes and tearing the bosom with red-hot pincers.
The witcher didn't say a word.
It is called exemplary terror, Fulco Artevelde continued. Absolutely imperative in the fight against crime. Why do you clench your fist so hard I can almost hear your knuckles grinding? Perhaps you favor humane killing? You can afford that luxury. You mainly fight creatures which, however ridiculous it sounds, also kill humanely. I cannot afford it. I've seen merchants' convoys and homes pillaged by Nightingale and his like. I've seen what's done to people to make them reveal hiding places or magical passwords to jewel cases and strong boxes. I've seen the women Nightingale has taken a knife to, just to check they weren't concealing valuables. I've seen worse things done to people simply for the sake of wanton amusement.
Angoulême, whose faith moves you so, took part in such merriment. That is certain. She was in the gang long enough, and were it not for sheer accident and the fact she fled the gang, no one would have found out about the ambush in Belhaven, and you would have learned of it some other way. Perhaps she'd have shot you in the back with a crossbow.
I don't like speculation. Do you know why she fled the gang?
Her evidence in that regard was vague, and she didn't want to divulge it to my men. But it's no secret that Nightingale is one of those men who restrict women to a primitively natural role. If he can't do it any other way, he forces that role on women. Certainly, generational conflicts contributed to it. Nightingale is a mature man, while Angoulême's last gang were urchins like her. But those are speculations. In actual fact, it interests me not. And why, may I ask, do you care? Why has Angoulême evoked such interest from the moment you saw her?
Strange question. The girl informs me about an attempt on my life being planned by her former comrades on the orders of some half-elf. A sensational matter in itself, since I have no long-standing feuds with any half-elves. The girl knows only too well what company I ride with, including such details as the troubadour being called Dandelion, and that the woman has cut off her plait. That plait, particularly, makes me suspect lies or a trap in this.
It wouldn't have been hard to seize and question one of the forest beekeepers I've been journeying with for the last week, and swiftly stage a, "That will do."
Artivelde slammed his fist on the table.
"You race too far ahead, sir. You're accusing me of engineering something here. To what end? To deceive or ensnare you? And who are you that you so fear provocation and ensnarement? Only the thief fears the truth, my lord Witcher. Only the thief. Give me another explanation."
"No, you give me one, sir.
Regrettably, I have none."
"I might say something." The prefect smiled maliciously.
"But for what? Let's be clear. I'm not interested in who wants to see you dead or why. I don't care where that person came by such interesting information about you, including your comrade's hair color and length. I shall go further. I might have not informed you at all about the plot on your life, Fitcher. I could..."